gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome to another edition of Nerdy Notions, where Sasha is already discombobulated and we haven't even started yet.
Okay, it's not my fault. It's actually Mike's fault because I was perfectly ready for first class. And then I just happened to mention that I already started watching Days of Future Past and I have issues with that movie. And then Mike went, but the Wolverine is next. And I completely forgot that movie existed because after last week, I literally do not want to see Wolverine ever again. But I'm not allowed to be happy because Bryan Singer has a hard-on the size of, well, Wolverine. But that's not what we're talking about today. Today, we are talking about what should have been a Magneto Origins film, but instead became a semi-discombobulated, but still adorably lovable, and in my opinion, the superior X-Men film to all the others. Fight me. Today, we are talking about X-Men First Class. And we begin someplace new, someplace refreshing, someplace we never seen before. Nope, it's Poland, it's 1944. So this film to give a little bit of background, this movie was meant to be semi-standalone. Part of it, I think, was to attract the people that were like in love with the original trilogy, but without making a direct prequel. We're going to talk about how all of the lovely concepts and things established in the movie get absolutely pissed upon by Bryan Singer when we get to Days of Future Past.
In two
films. But we're not there yet. Well, this is the movie that, like, the Wolverine has nothing to do with this movie, really.
Well, yeah. So, it's not until, like, when we get to Wolverine next week that it kind of feeds a bit into Days of Future Past because it is the bridge. One thing that should be noted is that Matthew Vaughn directed this film. And Matthew Vaughn, obviously the genius behind the Kingsman franchise, which is also based off of comics. So Matthew Vaughn is a legitimate comic nerd.
And it shows. And I admit, like, I have some issues with this movie, but we'll go to them. But at the same time, this movie has so many things that made me want to stand up in the movie theater and clap. So we're going to get to all of those things. And I will say that, like, having watched Kingsman and having rewatched First Class afterwards, you do start to see this specific style that Matthew Vaughn has. And I actually appreciate it. I think he has a nice directorial style. And it's interesting that he signed up to direct this movie, despite the fact that he was set to direct The Last Stand, but then he left because of the studio and because he had less time to do it. But with this movie, he has even less time to do it. But he still did it, and I think this movie cements to me why Vaughn should have stuck it out with X-Men The Last Stand and why they should not have taken the X-Men away from him. So we're going to get to all of that.
Well, let's also put this out there. If he didn't do this film, he probably would not have been able to do Kingsman.
I think he probably would have found a way to do Kingsman and this movie and the sequels. Like, you know what? We'll talk about this. So let's go back to Poland in 1944, where nothing happy ever happened. So we begin, as I mentioned, exactly kind of similarly to X-Men 2000. It's not a shot-for-shot remake of what happened. It's very similar, but we see it kind of slightly from a different angle. As Jews are being separated, Eric is, again, it's not quite as clear how he's separated. He's kind of like pulled away by the soldiers. I guess he's meant to go to the work camp while his parents are not going to be, they're pretty much being led to what I assume is the gas chambers. So the soldiers hold him back and then his powers manifest and they bend the gate. We find out later that the gate is Auschwitz. He is then knocked out. We flash then to 1944, Westchester, New York, where a little boy in fancy schmancy blue pajamas in a mansion with a baseball bat comes kind of downstairs and into the kitchen, and he sees his very nicely dressed mom for the middle of the night. And she is like rummaging around in the fridge. And she's like, I'll make you a hot chocolate. But Charles is already suspicious of her. It turns out that this is not his mother, because his mother would never offer him a hot chocolate unless he count ordering the maid to do it. Mom's kind of posh.
Yeah, and should I also note real quick how adorable young Charles looks like walking around the house with a baseball bat?
Cute kid, I'll give you credit. Yeah. Cute kid. So Charles is happy to. So Charles, excuse me. Charles says, "You're not my mother. So who are you?" And the mom, because he also like sees a photo, which is black and white, and then sees that like. So anyway, it's revealed that this is Mystique, for some reason. Basically, she's a homeless kid, I guess, a homeless little blue girl. So I guess her powers manifested like earlier. But, okay, I mean, you know, powers manifest at various points in the development and puberty of people, so whatever, fine.
And it's actually one of the things that's explored in Deadpool, the first film.
Not really, but okay.
It is.
Sort of, kind of, not really.
Yeah, but it's still explored.
We'll get there when we get there. So... Charles is happy to meet her and basically lets her stay and says, "You'll never have to starve again." But he says, "I knew I couldn't be the only one." I mean, okay, sure. But I guess what happened, and we're not really ever given an explanation, but the most likely thing is Charles messes with mommy and daddy's brains for them to think that Raven is their like daughter and Charles's little sister. It's never really explored, but it should be noted, this is a concoction of the movie. And I'm going to state this right now. I haven't even gotten to Jennifer Lawrence. She sucks. She absolutely sucks. I've seen her in other films, and she's fine in other films. I don't know what was wrong with her in these movies. I don't give two shits. I really don't. I know it was the makeup and the prosthetics. Like, I don't give a shit. I don't. She sucks. Her character throughout these movies is completely pointless. She could be replaced with a dancing monkey. She could be replaced with any X-Men villain throughout these films and have a more better point to it, except with maybe one exception. All right, so we're going to get there. Anyway, we're still in 1944, but we flash back to Nazi Germany. A man is played by the sultry and very evil Kevin Bacon. Kevin Bacon is really good at playing bad guys. There's some actors that are good at playing good guys and bad guys, but he's just such a good bad guy. Ugh. So the man asks, he offers him like some chocolate at first. And I will give Kevin Bacon credit. His German accent is not the worst I've ever seen. His Russian accent was not that great, but I will say I've heard much worse. But we'll get there. So the man asks Eric just wants his mom. But the man says like, "Hey, move the coin," like he moved the gate, but it doesn't work. He can't do it. So this man who, I guess his name, we find out a little bit later that his name is Schmidt, but he says that he doesn't like the Nazis' methods, but he appreciates their results. So basically they bring his mom in and Nazi guy's like, oh, he's like not a Nazi because he doesn't like the Nazis' version of perfection. So we find out later that the villain here is the Schmidt guy, but he's Sebastian Shaw. And can I just say, this would have been so much better if the villain was Nathaniel Essex, because we know for a fact Nathaniel Essex was at concentration camps experimenting on humans. So to kind of clarify some of the storylines they're combining here, you have Nathaniel Essex, aka Mr. Sinister, being combined with the Hellfire Club and X-Men First Class. So you've got like three or four comics going on here at once in a sort of a smorgasbord. And this works significantly better than it has in the past. But we'll explore why in a bit. So he says, "Move the coin or I kill mommy." And it's fine. Basically, Eric can't move the coin. Mom says that like everything will be fine. I'm not sure why mommy speaks. So by 1944, if I remember correctly, the Nazis were deporting Jews out of like Budapest and Hungary. So I'm not sure like my like timeline of deportations and Holocaust history isn't the best, but my guess would have been that like most, if not all, of the German Jews would have been like carted off. But I guess there were even deportations in 1944 out of Germany, so anything is possible. But anyway, for those that don't know, Eric actually grew up in Germany before the Nazis took over and then everything, all this happened. But so mom says everything is all right, but this guy still kills the mom. Out of anger, he makes everything like rattle and all of the metal, and it actually pans back a little bit before this, because before this we just see Shaw talking to this really sweet little Eric who was about to lose all his innocence. And then after Eric moves the coin and they bring in the mom, it actually pans over and we see his like laboratory, which is full of like instruments of various calibers. So he destroys everything. He kills the Nazi guards by like crushing their helmets, which is like the best way to kill Nazis in my opinion. Things get thrown in the lab around, and Shaw laughs as he watches. He congratulates him, talks about what they're going to do together. And he's like, talks about something like anger and pain. But the coin itself, we see that it's a Nazi coin. But as we kind of zoom in on the coin, it flips to become the X symbol. So now we are in the more present. We see an adult Eric, because he's flipping the coin around, in Geneva in what is now 1962. What historical events are important for 1962?
Cold War.
All right, that's one. Who's the president in 1962?
If I remember right, Kennedy.
That is correct. All right, these are important factors that we need to be aware of for this movie. So we see an adult Eric in Geneva, and he is on a quest of vengeance because we see kind of like these like, he has a creepy ass murderer wall situation. Like he's tracking somebody. So we then flash to Oxford, England, in a bar where Charles flirts with a girl using science, and her coolness factor is that she has two eyes that are different colors. Good for her. That is like, so Charles says like, oh, what you have is a mutation. And I'm like, I just remember rolling my eyes when I saw this, because this is such a dork. This is like just dorky level young Charles I can get behind. He uses his powers to guess her drink, says she is a mutant. She's like, so you're calling me deformed? He says, it's not deformity. And then she mentions something about reclaiming the term, and then they chuckle and say mutant and proud. I'm sure that will become a thing. They toast. Then Raven appears, played by Jennifer Lawrence. And she's annoyed because I guess Charles had gone to the bar to get her a cola. Something that really should have been clarified in this movie. How old is Raven supposed to be? Because she's clearly not 18. We're going to pause here dramatically while all of our negative 200 listeners think about it.
I think she's 62 years old.
I mean, we do know that she's older than she looks, but we don't actually have a clear number on her age, which becomes a little bit iffy later.
Well, when we get a little further along and we meet a specific character, he does say a line that kind of makes you think. So,
all right, I don't remember the line, so you'll have to remind me when we get there.
Yep.
All right, so Raven approaches. She is introduced as a sister or something, and she's a waitress. So I guess my question is, like, why is she a waitress? Like, if Charles made them think that she was his sister, like, wouldn't they have wanted her to, or is this one of those things where, like, girls don't go to college, even though it's 1962 and there are tons of women's colleges around? Hashtag things that did not get explained, but also it's Raven, so we don't, also this version of Raven, so we don't really care. So Charles thinks it, oh, she's like, she does her thing, her mutant powers with the eyes, so that like the girl will leave. And Charles thinks she did it on purpose. She says she's sick of hiding. She talks about how, like, he's, like, the pretty mutant because he doesn't have to hide, which is kind of something that we see a little bit in X3. So Charles is scared of what exposure would mean. Valid. Mutant and proud, she replies mockingly. And this is when they're like back at the apartment and she's blue again. And they have this whole conversation about like, would you date me? And he's like, you're my oldest friend. She's like, I'm your only friend. And he's like, well, I'm incapable of thinking of you that way because you're like my sister. And which like, they don't really say that sister part. Like, why did they say oldest friend and not sister? Because I feel like that would have made it make more sense. So as Charles reads about mutant human species in any region, Eric goes to the bank. It says that this is from his thesis, that the resurgence of a more dominant species in the region or a mutated human species in the region usually means immediate extinction of the lesser species. The lesser species are the humans, the normies. So Eric goes to a pretty fancy Swiss bank. Why is this important? Although Switzerland was neutral during the war, a lot of banks helped Nazis hide their stashes, including Swiss ones. So Eric has some, like, a Nazi gold bar, which are illegal to possess. Because I think after the war, most of them were actually melted down. So he pretends that a friend sent him to the bank. But this is gold stolen from Jews. So then he says something, the gold is what remains of my people. I don't know if people are aware of this, but like not all Jews died in the Holocaust. So this is a very odd line because it kind of implies that this is the last remnant of the Jewish people when it's not. So he could have said this is the last remains of my family because he is the only survivor of his family. That would make more sense. But this is what remains of my people just kind of implies like they were all eradicated and he's the only one left. Which, as Mike and I are here today, is not in fact true. The fact that there's, I think, like an 8 million Jewish population at this point plus around the world. So like clearly the Nazis did not succeed.
Yep.
So it was just an odd line that like, I don't like, again, because like when we rewatch these films, or as I will be watching The Wolverine for the first time, you're watching it with more critical eyes and ears in this case. So when I heard this line, I was like, what? That doesn't quite make sense, but all right. So he is looking for a man named Klaus Schmidt. This is funny because another character in the Marvel Universe had a dealings with a man named Johann Schmidt. Who, Michael, is Johann Schmidt?
Kevin Bacon?
No, that's Klaus Schmidt in the Marvel Universe.
Red Mask or Red Skull.
There you go. I know you would have found it eventually.
Sorry, I'm looking up information for you for when we get to that part because I want to find the exact line that was said.
You're good. We'll get
and
there.
I'm also having somebody message me at the same time, so.
We'll get back to my rantings then while you continue your research. This is what makes me think that Nathaniel Essex would have been a much better villain. So I think this movie came out the same year that Captain America did, give or take. So 2011. So it's funny to me for a number of reasons that his name in like Sebastian Shaw's name in Nazi Germany was Klaus Schmidt, which only proves that Nathaniel Essex should have been the villain of this movie. Because Sebastian Shaw is a greedy opportunist who wants power. He doesn't really delve too deeply into experimentation on mutants as far as I remember. And also, it's kind of unclear what kinds of things he actually did to mutants. Or with mutants. But we'll get to that. So he's looking for Klaus Schmidt, and the guy, this Swiss guy's like, oh, I don't know anything about that, and he's like starts pulling out his metal filling, which was like, ugh, that was like the ugh scene. But he pulls it out and he finds out that, you know, where could Schmidt be? Gee, where did Nazis flee to escape persecution? What country could it possibly be? Gosh, I just don't know. Oh my God, it's Argentina. Come on, it was so obvious. So, okay, Eric takes the metal filling out and takes the gold and leaves after threatening the guy. Basically, it was like, I'll come back and finish the job. There's also a funny scene where the guy tries to hit the panic button and Eric just like waves his hands out because he has a metal like watch because, you know, Swiss watch. We're going to go to Vegas now, where a male agent and a female agent are on a stakeout in front of the Hellfire Club in Vegas. The girl agent, she will be called girl agent until she gets a name. But I think she is actually, I don't think they name her yet. I think they actually name her later, but she is Moira McTaggart. So this is like the second time that Moira McTaggart exists, but is like not doing the thing she's actually supposed to be doing. And for some reason still doesn't have a Scottish accent. Matthew Vaughn actually told everybody, for the most part, not to do accents. The only exception is kind of Fassbender, but that's kind of because his accent naturally is kind of like a mix of Irish and German. So why couldn't Moira McTaggart have a proper Scottish accent? Why? I guess because she's
I actually
to be,
have the answer to this
she,
one.
Because she's supposed to be American, I guess, in this. But
no,
go for it.
No. The reason for it, I actually read this a little earlier. Matthew Vaughn actually wanted the actors to lose a lot of their accents.
Yeah, I just said that. He said no accents, but like...
So Fassbender, he let hit slip much later in the film, though, when he was doing his...
Yeah, when he was coming out of the plane, I remember. Yeah. Or the submarine.
He didn't want Moira to have the Scottish accent, which was to the mild disappointment of James McAvoy. McAvoy was originally going to try to mimic the accent of Patrick Stewart, to which also Matthew Vaughn squashed.
Which is a good thing.
So, the way a lot of people saw it was that he was going to lead into, kind of same way with Michael Fassbender, lead into the Patrick Stewart, Ian McKellen versions of the characters.
McKellen, not McKellen. But anyway.
I'm not looking at that part.
Anyway, I will say I appreciate the accent choices for everybody, except Moira McTaggart really should have had a Scottish accent. I don't care if she's supposed to be American. I don't. Anyway, so Moira works for the CIA. And basically this is some kind of gentleman's club where women show up in like, you know, sexy lingerie. So she gets undressed and goes into the club. We meet a woman named Emma. This is Emma Frost. She works for Shaw, which actually makes sense from the comics if you read the Phoenix Saga and all that jazz. She takes some Colonel inside to see him. The Moira, I still have her listed here as girl agent, sees the private booth, but no one is in it. So she realizes there's like a secret like switch or something. She hits a button in the center of the table and it like takes her downstairs. So Shaw wants US nukes in Turkey and wants this colonel to vote in favor of this, which previously he'd been against. Girl agent sees a Russian memo report, and Shaw shows off his mutant assets, which is a guy who can create like hurricanes and I guess control wind, and Azazel, who is Russian and in this for some reason, and has an accent and is red and says comrade. I wish I was kidding. Basically, he gets the colonel gets knocked back a little bit. Emma is in on, so Emma gets into the colonel's head. She shows off her diamond form, which actually did kind of a pretty cool version of, I appreciate it. Then Azazel takes the colonel to the UN. So meanwhile, Moira gets back and calls her boss, who is at the security briefing, and is like, this is what happened, the colonel and Shaw. He's like, dude, I'm in like DC, you're in Vegas. Shaw is literally, or the colonel just like literally walked into the room. So like, what the heck? So Moira's partner, whose name is like Levinson or something, was like, so what do we do now? They said, well, Moira goes, well, we need an expert on genetic mutation. Charles is once again in a pub and he's getting drunk because he passes. Oh, he's a professor now. He passed his dissertation or whatever. But he says, oh, I'm not good. I can't be a professor until I actually have students or whatever. Meanwhile, Eric arrives in Argentina and walks into a bar on the beach. This is hands down the best scene in the entire movie. Kudos to Fassbender for the absolutely amazing acting. I fucking love this scene. So he sees a pic of Shaw on the wall between two, like right by the bar. And there's like a boat. So there's two guys behind him. So it's like, oh, like, where are you guys? Oh, they serve German beer. Deutsche Bier. So there's like two Nazi guys there. One says like he was a pig farmer. And Eric says, oh, I was a tailor. My father had the best suits in Dusseldorf. And Eric says, oh, my family was from Dusseldorf. And these guys are kind of like, should we be suspicious? We should probably be suspicious. He says, but they're like, oh, what was their names? He goes, oh, they didn't have names. Their names were taken away from them by pig farmers and tailors. And they like actually clink the beer glasses. And then he shows them the tattoo, his concentration camp tattoo. I'm like, this scene is so satisfying. I can't. So the pig farmer guy pulls out a knife. And he takes the knife. It says blood and honor. So Eric takes the knife because it's, you know, metal. It says blood and honor. Which would you like to shed first? And the pig farmer goes, we were under orders. She goes, blood then, and just stabs him in the hand. The bartender, meanwhile, grabs a gun and tries to shoot. Eric redirects the gun to hit the tailor. And then this is cool. Eric grabs the knife, stabs the bartender, and returns the knife just to stab it right back in this Nazi pig farmer's arm. And then Eric finishes his beer. And then the crying Nazi goes, what are you? And Eric says, I'm Frankenstein's monster, and I'm looking for my creator. And then he kills the Nazi guy. But it's cool. Like, he just, like, finishes his drink and, like, casually leaves. It's such a satisfying scene. It's so good. So Charles, meanwhile, is getting drunk at the same bar, and I guess, like, does Raven not drink or something? Like, why do they emphasize that she needs another cola constantly? But anyway, so Moira arrives and introduces herself. This is when we actually get to hear that her name is Moira McTaggart. He does the same shtick that he did at the beginning of the movie with the girl. It doesn't work on her, but she says she needs it. Moira says she needs his help. He probes her bind, sees what she saw, and's like, okay, I'll help you. Meanwhile, in Florida, the colonel goes to see Shaw. They're on a boat. The colonel can't, so the colonel's like, I'm gonna pull the pin because I won't let you kill me or whatever, but he can't do it. So Shaw does it and like absorbs the energy. And then he kills the colonel with kind of just like a tap on the shoulder. Charles tries to brief the CIA about mutants to prove that what Moira saw actually happened. They still don't really believe. We see Stryker as an old guy with a son. Like, this was stupid. I'm sorry. We didn't need this cameo of Stryker. We really didn't. It could have been literally anybody. It could have been like a... There were so many possibilities that they could have done with it. But anyway. So Raven rescues them before they leave and like shifts into Stryker. And they're like, oh, this is a trick.
No, she doesn't turn into Stryker.
Yes, she does.
Stryker is the guy at the end of the table.
Yeah, she shifts into Stryker. No,
she doesn't turn into Stryker. She turns into the other guy.
No, she turns into Stryker. 10-10, look up the scene. I'll wait. She turns into Stryker.
Hold on, give me a second. I actually don't need to do that because I actually have the cast list in front of me.
Anyway, so while Mike is figuring out that I'm right, the guy from the back, who's played by Oliver Platt, says, oh, best I've ever seen. And then they're about to take them to like another facility while the CIA stooges contemplate what they've seen. And he says that they can go to his offside facility. Meanwhile, her – oh, Levine, that's his name.
Okay, no, praises. I got it screwed up. Matt Craven played the CIA director.
Yeah, so, no. Yeah.
So, you're right. It was Stryker who was next to – but that's not the William Stryker.
I don't care.
The actual cameo that you're thinking about is actually at the very end of the film because he's actually sitting off in the back because he has the brown hair. That's the actual actor who plays Stryker moving forward.
I don't care.
Yeah.
So. I don't care. Like, we did not need a Stryker. Stryker becomes... We've already seen a Stryker in the stupid movie we reviewed last week. We saw Stryker in X2. We did not need this.
Yeah. So, but yeah. So
anyway, so... Basically, let's see. Freezes. Charles is in Moira's mind. A guy is the CIA guy is basically kind of a laughingstock, but everyone agrees that they need to go after Shaw. Eric, meanwhile, arrives in a boat and confronts Shaw. Emma stops him and hurts his head, but then Shaw's like, "Oh, we don't harm our own kind." Basically, Eric gets knocked away as the Coast Guard arrive, and Emma's like, "There's a telepath on board," and then Charles on the other side is like, "Oh, that's interesting. I think there's somebody like me on this other boat." Anyway, so the wind guy sends tornadoes to hurt folks. Eric does things with chains, like that actually sounds way kinkier than it actually is. Basically, he grabs the anchor because he's in the water and, like, rams it through the boat, which was actually pretty cool. Charles senses him. So he breaks the ship with the anchor. Shaw and Emma and the wind guy escape in a submarine. Charles says he has to let them go. He, like, dives in after Charles goes into the water to save Eric. Eric, though, thought he was alone. Covert CIA, they go to the covert CIA research base after this. Run by the black suit guy who does not have a name. He's credited as Man in Black Suit.
Which I actually was waiting for this part right here. I just want to throw this out there. After much research, apparently the name that he was supposed to get was FBI Director Fred Duncan.
Man in Black Suit it is then.
Yeah. So I just want to throw that out there. And then also, I want to go back real quick to Stryker because I know you hate him, and that's perfectly okay. There's a line in the film in that scene when they actually show off Stryker, and Charles actually states, I hear you're thinking about your son and the things he's going to do. That is an indicator that's not the Stryker that you're looking in.
I still don't care.
Yeah.
I don't. You've seen one Stryker, you've seen them all.
Oh, but let's be honest, the actor who played Stryker in both films
are amazing actors. I have literally nothing against the actors. I feel bad that the one actor from X-Men Origins got stuck in a shit movie, and I liked what they did with Stryker in X2. But it's kind of like oversaturation, like, I've seen it, let's move on.
Yeah.
I guess these are supposed to be like little Easter eggs to the original trilogy, which is cute, but like after X-Men Origins, you really should not have included anybody named Stryker. Just saying. Anyway, so they get to this base and Eric in tow. And Oliver Platt's character is a laughingstock because this department like investigates paranormal powers, which actually for the CIA isn't that far of a stretch considering what they were doing in the 60s. So like the rest of the CIA has absolutely no room to judge this man. So Shaw works for the Russians, allegedly, according to what the CIA thinks they know. We meet Hank McCoy, who looks absolutely nothing like a Hank McCoy could have ever possibly looked at as a kid. It's like, for some reason, they found the, like the most stereotypical looking nerd actor to play Hank when, like, yes, Hank is nerdy, but he's built kind of like a short, bulky guy. Like, he's not, like a nerd. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like... What's the name of the, it's kind of like, what's the, from like the Big Bang Theory, what are the names?
I don't know. I don't watch that crappy TV show.
I watched a couple episodes, but like it's like the tall, neurotic one and the shorter one that gets with the blonde girl. Like that guy would have been a better Beast, Hank McCoy. Just because he's bigger.
Apparently Taylor Lautner was up for the role, but then he had to drop out of the film.
Yeah, nope.
It would have been better,
but still no.
But then they casted Nicholas Holt, which I actually like the actor Nicholas. So
I liked him. I like him in other stuff. It's just like he doesn't feel like he's like, I don't know. Out of all of the actors who play characters, he's the only one that doesn't feel like he's in the right skin in this role. Like, I don't know if that was on purpose or not, but it's just like he doesn't fit.
Well, it's interesting because as I was looking up like the trivia tidbits and stuff like that, it was noted that Nicholas Holt watched Last Stand, who watched Kelsey Grammer's take on the character. And he also, in an interesting way, watched a lot of Frasier to study Kelsey Grammer, which, like, that is like a complete 180.
Which kind of, I think, is the problem. I think he watched too much Frasier when he should have been watching the, like, 90s X-Men cartoon.
And with that said, I think that's why it probably took him a while to really fit into the role, because
he never fit into the role. But
the same thing actually can be said about Michael Fassbender. Fassbender watched all of Ian's stuff in the X-Men films as Magneto, but then he also did something different, which is the complete opposite of what Nicholas Holt did.
I think
he actually read the comics to actually help develop his character.
So Holt needed to watch less Frasier and more X-Men the Animated Series, whereas like this is like the study of what Fassbender's like what to do. Watch what the previous actor's done, but make it your own and study the source material. Holt was like, don't do this. Okay, that is my personal opinion. That is what I'm sticking with. So anyway, so Charles is a dumbass and accidentally outs this poor mutant kid as a mutant. He's like, oh, you didn't tell me that a mutant worked here. And Oliver Platt's character is like, what? And Charles is like, oops. I'm like, dude, are you kidding me? You were literally just like a few scenes ago talking about like how bad exposure could be. Like, are you kidding me? Anyway, this proves that like Charles isn't like the Charles we know. He's still kind of a noob. Anyway, we also see that, like, Hank has some, like, internalized mutant phobia, and he's, Raven and him flirt because they're both blue. It's not, like, I do not understand this.
So, no, I'm actually gonna hop into this part. This is where...
Is it because Jennifer Lawrence and Nicholas Holt started dating or something?
No. It, like, that's something I read and I was like, okay, that's cute, and then I kept scrolling. No, I'm actually going to use this as the opportunity to talk about the line that's used about, because you talked about how old Raven is in the film. There's actually one of the scenes where it's the two of them together.
We're not there yet. I know the scene you're talking about. Okay. We're not there yet.
Then all right.
That happens when they're at the X-Mansion and at the lab, but they're still flirting. But I know the line you're talking about. Yes. Yeah. We'll get there.
All right, okay, good. I'm leading us in the right direction.
So anyway, if you haven't clued in yet with the whole Turkish missiles, American missiles pointed, or American missiles in Turkey pointed at the Soviet Union, we're about to enter the Cuban Missile Crisis. Shah wants a war between the United States and the Soviet Union. A nuclear war. Just to be clear, nuclear war. We also learn in the submarine, Shaw has a special helmet that looks vaguely familiar.
That won't play any role in anything at all. No, fuck that.
This helmet will protect him from telepaths. So we actually demonstrate where like Emma can't read his mind. He's got a fancy submarine for the 1960s. So he says the Russians made him the helmet. How? Like, I can believe that Shaw made the helmet after, like, experimenting on mutants at Auschwitz or whatever, but, like, I can't see the logic of the Soviets making a helmet like this. But whatever. So the sub is hiding out somewhere cold because, like, Emma actually goes out of the submarine to, like, get him ice. Hank tries to look for a cure. Gee, where have I heard that before? Mystique is on board, and I guess he thinks that maybe her mutation is the key because she can change shape. I'm also still asking the question, why is Hank and Mystique a thing? Out of all of the characters she's been romantically linked with, Beast is not one of them. Wolverine comes before Beast. Like, do you know how many men and women are there before Beast shows? Like,
well, the interesting thing is that I was reading that, like, for the original class, it's Angel Warren Worthington III.
Yeah.
It's Scott Summers. It's Jean Grey. And blanking on
Beast and Bobby Drake, aka Iceman. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's like the real first class.
Yeah. It was funny when I went to see this movie. I was at the movie theater, and I remember this very clearly. I don't remember if I was seeing this or something else. But somebody was like, "Yeah, it has the original." Something we started talking about the original X-Men, and he started to mansplain to me about the original X-Men. And I'm like, well, and I was like, you know, Jean and Scott and Beast and Bobby and Warren and Angel. He's like, oh, Angel wasn't an original X-Men. I'm like, yes, he was. And he's like, no, he wasn't. I'm like, dude, go read a comic from the 1960s and shut up.
Yeah.
Do not mess with me.
Oh, when we finally get to the DC movies.
God help me.
I think when we do Suicide Squad. I have a great story on that one from when Brian and I saw that in Los Angeles. Because we actually saw the movie in Los Angeles, and there's a great story to it.
All right, we'll leave the story for when we get to that shit show. So anyway, Eric interrupts their moment and says they're talking about like the cure and like looking human and like not affecting powers. And Eric interrupts their moment and basically says that if he looked like her, cause he saw her blue, he wouldn't change a thing. So the CIA files, they take the CIA files and leave, Eric takes some files basically on Shaw, I'm guessing, and leaves. And Charles doesn't really try to stop him, but sort of stops him anyway. Charles reveals that he saw/felt the agony that Eric felt and kind of knows what happened to him because he poked around in his brain. And that he, you know, maybe might need a friend. So Hank designed a transmitter, like, conveniently to locate other mutants. But he needs a telepath. Like, was Hank hoping that a telepath would just, like, randomly appear? Or was he hoping to adapt it to, like, search through genetic material that he has or something like that? Because, like, you need a telepath for Cerebro. Which is why I think anybody that thinks, this also like leads me to the concept of the prequel. And somebody was like, oh, this is a prequel to the films, to the original X-Men trilogy. No, it's not. Anybody who tells you is an idiot. This movie, I'm serious. This movie, the only thing these two movies have in common is Eric as a Holocaust survivor because nothing else is accurate. Charles did not invent Cerebro like in the original trilogy from the 2000s.
I mean, the thing is that it's one of those it is and it isn't at the same time.
So
because of the fact of what this eventually leads to with Days of
Future. We're not there yet. We're not talking about where this leads to. We're talking about this movie by itself as it is in 2011. Yeah. So by itself, this is not a prequel. This is a reboot. And it works much better as a reboot. Because there's so many continuity mistakes. And Vaughn did that on purpose. I think these little bits are meant to be Easter eggs. They are not meant, like the bits that are accurate, with the exception of the Holocaust stuff, are meant to be callbacks. And Easter eggs. They're not meant to actually fit into the continuity. They screw that up later, but we're not there yet. All right, so basically Eric agrees to stay and they're gonna find other mutants using Cerebro. So Eric says that Charles, and him should be the ones. So Eric comes back when Charles and the FBI agent, man in black guy, are talking about finding the mutants. And Eric is like, okay, but we're gonna use Cerebro and we're gonna find the mutants, not the CIA. And Dijon's like, oh, well, I think, you know, Charles and I have come to an understanding. Charles is like, nope, I agree with Eric. The CIA basically has no choice because they can't use Cerebro without a telepath. And they make a joke as he's putting the helmet on about shaving his head. The joke is funny for two reasons. Number one, this joke is funny because, as we know, Charles Xavier in literally every other iteration except this one is actually bald. It's funny for a second reason because James McAvoy actually shaved his head before getting the memo that he did not need to shave his head for this movie. So it's a double joke.
Yeah, he actually had to wear hair extensions for a while.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Anyway. So the design of the machine kind of looks familiar, but I can't quite place it. I'm not sure why. Maybe because it looks like every other dorky brain machine that existed in, like, other sci-fi shit. So who knows? There's also a joke about Eric makes about Charles looking like an adorable lab rat. Can I just say that McAvoy and Fassbender have amazing chemistry to the point where, like, I understand why a lot of people started shipping Charles and Eric. I don't, and still will never, but I get it. So we see a mutant recruitment montage, and we get, like, a little bit of little hints of, like, oh, there's Scotty, oh, there's Storm, we will never see those kids again. Until Apocalypse, and ironically enough, ooh. Anyway. Charles and Eric find Angel, not to be confused with the Warren Worthington III. They actually find the other Angel, who is an exotic dancer and played by, was it Zoe Kravitz?
Yep, Zoe Kravitz, Lenny Kravitz's daughter.
Yeah, so Angel has like these cute fly wings, and it's actually pretty funny.
And apparently in the actual comic, her actual name is Angel.
Yes, and she ends up marrying a guy who looks like a chicken. Comics, don't question it.
I'm just going to remute my microphone and let you just take this away.
Anyway, so they have this moment where, like, we'll show you ours if you show me yours. And then he's like, Multivica, and, like, takes the, like, the metal tin that has the champagne, and, like, it, like, floats over to Charles. And she's like, oh, okay. So then she, like, takes off the top, like, she undoes the straps of her, like, bra thing and shows off her wings. Okay. So then they see a guy in a prison who actually prefers solitary confinement. He's Alex Summers. Okay. In the comics, Scott is Alex's older brother. So what I didn't realize at the time of my note taking is that there's like little hints and homages to the original X-Men with this. You have Angel, but it's not quite Angel. You have a Summers, but it's not Scott Summers. So cute, Matthew Vaughn, real cute.
And not only that, but I think also one of the reasons why they did it this way with Alex instead of Scott is because of the fact that, you know,
Scott is annoying and useless.
Well,
and whiny?
The James Marsden version, probably, but...
No, literally every single version of Scott is whiny and annoying, and he has a stick up his butt the size of Mount Rushmore.
But anyways, you've seen Scott in the animated series, the original trilogy, and all that stuff.
No, I get it. I get it.
So I think this was their way of going, you know, yeah, I know in the comics it's this way, we're going to do it the other way, just to kind of keep Scott out of it for a while.
Then bring him in later. I get that now. At the time, I was pretty annoyed, but I'm always annoyed. There are certain things I'm a purist at heart about.
I know you. This is the one episode I might actually have to put an NSFW next to.
How many times
you dropped the
S-bomb? This is a PG-13 podcast. There was one F bomb. There was one F bomb.
Two.
Was there two? Dang it! We're about to get to the third. So then they see a ginger kid, who in the comics is Banshee, which is actually pretty cool because Banshee was a character that was like introduced in the 70s. And his daughter also has his powers and like appeared in like X-Factor and eventually becomes like a Norse goddess or something. Comics, don't question it, but also cool character either way. So the ginger kid is like in an aquarium. We actually see Sasha Peters, who went on to have a role in a bunch of things, including Pretty Little Liars. And I'm making a note of that because she and I share a first name, which is a great first name. Anyway, So then they're at a bar, and there's a guy who looks strangely like Hugh Jackman. And they're like, excuse me. And he basically tells them to go fuck themselves.
Which,
and that is
which took 7 takes. Sorry, I'm eating a chicken nugget at the same time. It took 7 takes, and the only reason Jackman agreed to do it is because he got to be the only character to say fuck.
I think he's actually the only person that got to say fuck in any of the X-Men films until Deadpool.
Yes.
And technically the all Marvel-based films except for Blade, maybe.
Yeah, Blade, all three Blade movies definitely have the F-bomb in it.
So he's the only, hold on, let's rephrase. He is the only character in a Marvel-based film who got to drop the F-bomb in a PG-13 movie.
Yeah, because the Blade films and Deadpool were all
R-rated. Yep. Anyway, so Emma found nothing on sonar, but basically Emma senses Charles, and she senses because Cerebro's heightening his powers. So she's having Azazel and the wind guy like look for Charles when he's not there, but she can feel him. So there's something about like the mutant children of the Atom. She says that they're recruiting. So Shaw will find them as Emma goes to Russia. So Shaw's like, I'll deal with it. You go to Russia. I also noticed that they say Russia a lot instead of the Soviet Union. Just a reminder, it's the Soviet Union right now. It's not Russia. It's not really a big distinction. It's really not, but it is a distinction.
Well, let me ask you this, because you are from Russia.
Mm-hmm.
And so you would know the history a lot better than like someone like me. Even though
this episode's going to be really long, but go for it.
Even though it was called the Soviet Union then, back in like the 60s, 70s, 80s, and stuff like that, was Russia ever used as kind of like a quote-unquote nickname during that time period?
So yes and no. But I think it was more like, I don't know exactly, because Soviet era history is not my bit. You want to ask me, but like Catherine the Great era history is kind of more my thing. But so Russia still existed, I guess sort of used, but for the most part it was the Soviet Union, because that was the government. The Soviet Union was the Soviet Socialist Republics, whatever. So it's a conglomeration of basically like all of the everything from like Kazakhstan to like just before Poland was considered the Soviet Union. So it's a combination of different various republics that are all under this umbrella of the Soviet Union, whether they want to or not. So if you're saying like go to Moscow, you could say people that were born in Russia, their passports had born in the Soviet Union. So I could say like it could have still been used like culturally, but not necessarily like I would say in a professional setting.
Right.
So I found it weird.
And that was the kind of the point of the question is like, was it kind of like quote unquote a nickname of sorts? Kind of like how with the United States of America, we just kind of go with the shortened nickname of USA. You know what I'm saying?
It's not really the same thing. It's like, during the Soviet Union, nobody said St. Petersburg, they said Leningrad. So I would say yes, but like probably used more, I guess, outside of the Soviet Union than actually in the Soviet Union. But anyway.
Right. All right, fair enough.
So Charles
back
to the X-Men. So Charles and Eric, or the not yet X-Men, Charles and Eric play chess at the Lincoln Memorial, as one does, casually. And there's, like, no tourists. Like, I don't care if it's 1962 or 2020. There are still tourists in front of the Lincoln Memorial. I have a note about the allegory of anti-Semitism, because they talk about, like, selection and eradication. So remember how when, I think this was when we did the first X-Men film, I said about like everybody was like, oh, the X-Men are an allegory for gay rights. The X-Men are an allegory for civil rights. I'm like, all of these things are partially true, but more so based on who created these characters, Jack Kirby, that the actual allegory, if you want to really put an official stamp on it, is anti-Semitism. And all of these other things, racism, homophobia, all of these things are also true. But that's because the X-Men were created to be an allegory for everyone. But a lot of the comic storylines are almost, they're just so close to being directly about anti-Semitism. Like, but anyway, so the kids, so what happens when you leave a bunch of teenagers unsupervised in a room together?
Stupid stuff.
Exactly. So the kids want code names and to show everyone their powers and how cool they are. Oh, I think I actually forgot some recruitment. They also get a guy who drives a cab. He's important.
Yep.
Darwin.
I should also put it out there super quick because you're talking about like the anti-Semitism. And this is also probably still around the time where Stan Lee is still like a big player in Marvel.
And this is 1962. Like in terms of the time where the movie takes place canon?
I'm talking about outside canon. I'm talking about the comics in general.
In 2011? Nope.
No, I'm talking about like when the stuff... No, I'm not talking about 2011. I'm talking about when the comics were actually coming out.
So in 1962, yes, he was at Marvel. He's, he's co-creator.
Yeah, so... And Stan Lee is Jewish, so that kind of explains a little bit of that.
So know. Is Jack Kirby.
Yeah, so both of them...
I mentioned that.
Yeah, so
pretty much everybody at Marvel in the 60s was Jewish, except like John Romita. Like, like there's a lot of Jews that are like work to create these characters. Half the characters you know are created by Jews. Everybody from Batman to Zatanna, maybe not Zatanna, but like anyway. A lot of the Golden Age characters were all created by Jews. Superman, Captain America, Wonder Woman wasn't, but Batman was. Anyway.
It's intriguing.
The entire comic book industry was created by Jews. Will Eisner, Martin Goodman, all Jews. All right.
Yeah.
So Darwin adapts, hence why his name is Darwin. Poor name choice, but fair. Banshee breaks with the window. Angels has acid spit and wings. Alex Summers' powers are not kid-friendly. He's also kind of a dick. But I guess when you've been away from people so long, you turn a little nippy, even if you wanted to be away from people.
I actually like the fact that they actually made a point to do the difference of, you know, Scott has it come from the eyes and Alex has it come from the chest.
Chest or hands, depending on the iteration. But yeah, that's actually true in the comics as well.
Yeah, I like how there's that differentiation between the two. Because it actually does make the character more unique when you actually differentiate
them. And he's significantly less annoying than Scott Summers, so kudos. Well, not in the comics, but like in this movie. But he's annoying. Alex Summers in the comics is annoying for different reasons than Scott. But anyway. So they go out to see what Alex can do, and he like throws around energy with his body because he doesn't have like a focusing force yet. And Alex has bad power control. The CIA and basically Moira was right. But there's a bunch of guys who are like, oh, the kids are freaks and whatnot. And the kids come up with code names for Charles and Eric. But there's way too much attention still being given to Mystique. So Charles and Eric have to go to Russia. But the nicknames they have chosen for Charles and Eric is Eric will be Magneto and Charles will be Professor X. And so everybody has their code names. Good for them. So Charles and Eric go to Russia. There's a checkpoint and Charles dupes the Soviet soldiers so they don't see him and the other people inside the truck, back of the truck. So Emma comes to see some dude who I guess is the defense minister. They don't really specify who he is exactly, but he's definitely not Joseph Stalin. But Eric does cool things. Basically, you're like, oh, Shaw's not here. It's Emma. Eric's like, I don't care. I'm going after her. And he does cool things with barbed wire. So he basically walks through all the soldiers. Emma goes diamond as they enter. So it's actually really funny because Emma, when we pan back to what Emma is doing with the Soviet guy, it looks like they're about to do the dirty, but then it pans and it's all in this guy's head induced by Emma while she's like munching on a cracker. It's actually pretty funny. But then Eric breaks in, Emma goes into her diamond form, and Charles can't read her when she's in her diamond form. He probably wouldn't have been able to read her anyway, because she's a pretty powerful telepath, I guess, in this. But Eric's tactics of torture work, and she breaks her diamond form. He, like, uses the metal rims of the bed to, like, tie her up, basically.
He pretty much, it kind of comes back to that line that, that Shaw said at the very beginning of the film. I'm not a fan of the Nazis, but their methods produces results.
And this will be something I talk about in the end when Eric finally confronts Charles about, when Eric finally confronts Shaw about why I have a very big problem with a part of this movie.
Yeah. So, and this is like one of those things of like,
yeah,
don't like them, but the methods.
Well, I mean, torture is not strictly a Nazi tactic, especially the way that they're doing it. But, it was used in the, it's used, I would say this is more, I would argue this is more of a Wild West tactic than a Nazi tactic. But yes, I know the symbolism and the,
But let me put it like this. It's not to Charles's liking, per se.
Charles is a dainty little, dapper, pansy, what's the Victorian term? Anyway. So Emma doesn't stop him from reading her mind, and they see Shaw's plan. Shaw's plan is to start nuclear war so that all the humans will be eradicated and the mutants will rise, because more nukes means more mutants. They are children of the atom. So back with the mutant kids, I guess there's like some magic teleportation thing that, like, it's kind of, the passage of time during these couple of scenes is a little bit weird. Just because it still looks like nothing changes in the timeline of, like, the kids being in the room. And then Charles and Eric going to Russia. But minor issue. So back with the mutant kids, the CIA guys are still dicks. And they make fun of them. There's an odd noise. And Shaw's there. Azazel's there. And they start, like, walking, absolutely thrashing the CIA guys. They do not put up much of a fight.
Poor Oliver Platt.
Yeah, he dies in this. And Shaw's here for the kids. We see the broken glass. The agents are dying via Azazel. Shaw destroys other agents in a building. Shaw's not there to hurt the mutant kids. He's actually, like, makes a point of that. So the revolution is coming, he tells them once he actually enters and, like, meets with them. It says, rise up to rule. We will rise up to rule. So you're either with us or against us. Fight for those, like, what are you going to do? Fight for those who hate you. And in a fun twist of events, Angel actually sides with Shaw. Darwin pretends to go too, but he adapts to survive. And then Alex lets one of his, like, power rings rip. Shaw absorbs it. And he uses the energy to kill Darwin, who should have been able to survive this. He can literally adapt to withstand anything. They literally killed the only black character in this movie. For no reason other than, like, being a catalyst of, like, blah, 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 blah.
True. Zoe Kravitz is technically black.
Yeah, but they don't kill her until the next movie. We haven't gotten there yet. I agree with you, yes, but we're not there yet. She's also Jewish.
That's true.
So, who should have been, blah, blah, blah. So, anyway, back in Moscow, then there's a military parade, and Shaw and this guy talk. So, it should be noted, the actor, this is actually pretty funny. So, all of the high-ranking Soviet characters are played by Americans trying to do Russian accents. All of the soldiers are actually native Russian speakers. And so, I will give this, the guy who plays this, like, not Stalin-esque general, his Russian is, like, not the best, but not the worst. It's, like, on par, I would say, with, like, Scarlett Johansson's Russian in the first Avengers movie. Like, it's decent. I can understand what he's saying. Anyway, so he wants the Soviets to put the missiles in Cuba. The Soviets say no, but the KGB, blah, 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 blah. Meanwhile, Charles and Eric arrive back at the CIA building, and there's a random taxi there. I don't know why. I'm guessing it's probably Darwin's taxi. So not only did he die, but he's got his car smashed too. So the kids, the kids want to do something. Eric says they're going to avenge. I'm like, wrong universe. You're not allowed to avenge anybody yet.
Give it four years.
Well, technically, well, anyway. So Emma is in a room because she was taken by the CIA. And there's like these two agents talking about her. And, but she, so she's one, it's one of those like, you know, plexiglass things where like they can see her, but she can't see them, even though she's a telepath. So this is stupid. So they're like, oh, this is a war. And then she like uses her diamond hand to like break the glass. And she's like, gentlemen, this is not a war, because a war implies two sides that have an equal chance of winning. So as I mentioned, so the subs are, the Soviet ships are approaching. There's going to be like a barricade. This is again, the Cuban Missile Crisis. So Charles takes them to the mansion, but like I said, we're not there at the ships yet. My bad. But they're going to put together a blockade. The Americans are, so that the Soviets don't get to Cuba. Eric and Charles train with a gun. So like Charles puts a gun. Eric has Charles point a gun to his head and is like, chew it, I can deflect it. And Eric's like, well, Charles is like, well, if you know you can deflect it, then it's not a challenge and I can't shoot you. You're my friend. But it should be pointed out that they go to what is later becomes the X Mansion. So Charles tells Eric that the secret isn't anger. Meanwhile, Alex gets a bunker tunnel because apparently Charles's dad was like obsessed with like survival. So there's like all these underground tunnels. Hint, hint, nudge, nudge, wink, wink. Hank and Charles train and like running, and there's like a Jekyll Hyde question of about like the true nature of the book and everything like that. And for some reason Hank has enhanced speed. I mean, I can see like it shouldn't be that fast. Like, he's not really generally fast. He's agile and he can jump high, but he's not fast. Anyway, Banshee, so Hank builds little things to help them. So for Banshee, he builds these like things to help him glide and use his scream to like fly, which is pretty cool. But the first time he does it, he just kind of falls. Meanwhile, Mystique is like doing some muscle things, and Eric comes in and he like drops the weights. He holds the weights in the air, and then he drops them, and she like so that she like reverts back to her power. He's like, if you're only you're using half your power to concentrate on maintaining this form and the other half on lifting weights, so you like basically you're better if you're blue situation.
It's better to be true to yourself and not trying to, you know, try to focus so much energy in something else.
Yeah. Also, it should be noted, Hank is just a little too much of an awkward nerd. There's the part where they put these mannequins for Hank, for Alex to practice on, and Hank like feels up the boob of the mannequin. I'm like, that was unnecessary. Like, that was completely unnecessary. Like, we get it, he's a nerd. You didn't have to tell us he's awkward with girls. We saw that. Eric actually ends up trying to like focus on moving the antenna that's in the distance, but the focus is not rage. So Eric lets Charles into his head. And of course, there has to be a scene involving Hanukkah. It couldn't be baking challah. It couldn't be lighting candles for Shabbat. It could be sitting down to dinner, or you know, literally anything else. It had to be Hanukkah candles. Fine. So there's a scene where him and his mom are lighting the Hanukkah candles. Mazel tov. Okay, you have a happy memory now. And Eric says something like, I didn't know I still had that. But the memory helps him to rechannel his powers away from anger and bitterness and rage. I'm sure that fixes everything. We hear Kennedy's speech, which actually, fun note, they slightly modified it. So when you see Kennedy on screen, that's his actual words. But when you see him off screen, when you hear his voice, that was somebody else because they changed the line slightly. Okay. Let's see. So Hank says that the serum is ready. It's not. And Raven questions them if they shouldn't have to hide. So this is right before this, there's a scene where that you were leading to earlier, yeah, where he says that her cells are regenerative. So even when she's like in her 40s, she's still going to look the same way she does now.
Yeah.
So I guess it's meant to be unclear. It's meant to like kind of vague us that she's probably older than she looks.
Yeah. And I think that's the point, because one of the things I was trying to look for, along with obviously the line of, you know, when he's talking about when he's looking at her jeans going like, oh, you're going to look a lot younger than you really are. Like when you're like in your 60s and stuff like that. Like, so it kind of begs the question of how old is she really?
We don't know.
And that's just something we don't know, because it was never kind of addressed in.
And I don't think we know much. If I remember, there's not really that much about her backstory in the comics either. She's definitely at least 100 years old, if not more. I would put her maybe a little bit younger than Wolverine.
Oh, she's definitely younger than Wolverine.
Oh, I don't mean by, like, a large margin. I mean by, like, 50 years at most. No, trust me, in the comics, yeah. Fight me. I know my comics. Anyway.
I'm not going to fight you. You know comics more than I do. So I read Power Rangers, you read X-Men, okay?
I read Marvel, and I actually haven't read the X-Men in a while, but anyway. So Raven, so Hank says the serum is ready. Raven questions if they shouldn't have to hide. Raven kind of talks him out of it, but Hank says they'll still be freaks. Eric plans to kill Shaw. After Cuba, mutants will be known. So no matter what they do, they will be known. Charles is very, so they're playing chess again, but Charles is naive and Eric is arrogant. Charles believes all humans are like Moira MacTaggert, where Eric believes all humans are like Shaw. So it's an interesting contrast they're actually really taking the time to dive into, which is pretty cool. So Charles says that killing Shaw will not bring peace, but Eric says peace was never an option. So Hank takes the serum, and at first it looks like it worked, but then it kind of works in reverse. I wonder what the effect will be. Meanwhile, Raven tries to hook up with Eric. And at first he's not receptive, and then she turns into Rebecca Romijn. And he's like, the real, so he says, you know, I want the real Raven. And she turns back into Rebecca Romijn. He's like, no, the real Raven. And then he kind of kisses her anyway when she's all blue. So she confronts Charles about how he's kind of tried to control her entire life or some other bullshit. He mentions the cure. And Charles is like, oh, well, you know, Hank says he fixed everything so it can be normal. And they don't really, so they kind of have a beginning of a conversation that just doesn't go anywhere. So Hank leaves them a note that says, bring a box marked X, but his entire lab is in shambles. But there's suits in it, and they're blue and yellow. They're mostly yellow. So they go to the airbase, and we see Hank. Hank is blue and fuzzy, but the design just looks awkward. I think because maybe like the, when they were making the costumes, they forgot that like it should have, the jacket should have been a little bit bigger to accommodate the blue and the furry. So it looks a little awkward. He's a bit more aggressive and beast-like. So they're like, oh, we're going to call you Beast now. Also the mouth prosthetic is awful on the blue Hank. It's awful. Yeah, you can tell his, it doesn't quite move as naturally. I think the way they did it for Kelsey Grammer was better. And I get they were basing the design for this version of Hank off of like some of the later comics, but it looks awkward. And unfortunately, I don't think they ever really fix it. So there's US troops being deployed to the barricade, to the blockade. There's a Soviet ship receives an orders to leave, but the others didn't. The Soviet ship tries to warn the Americans, who think this is a ruse. Charles forces Soviet guy to fire on his own ship because that ship is full of dead people. And Azazel is on the ship. Shaw is nearby, but he doesn't have sonar. But there's a Banshee. Oh, sorry. Shaw is nearby on a submarine and they need to find him. So they don't really have sonar. And Hank's like, oh gosh, I wish we had sonar. Banshee's like, hello, sonar. Echolocation. So they basically throw Banshee off the plane, sort of, like he jumps down so that he can find the thing. So Shaw plans to absorb the energy of a nuke, so he has power. So there's actually like a secret room in his stupid little submarine where he's going to be doing the absorption stuff. Eric uses his powers to get the sub out of the water. Lund guy? Submarine lands on the beach. The plane crashes, but everybody's fine. Charles reads Azazel's mind. Beast and Hank fight Azazel. The fight reaches U.S. ships because Azazel teleports. Banshee gives Angel a run for her money. Eric finds Shaw on a submarine in a hidden room. So basically they agree that Eric is going to go in the submarine and get Shaw because Charles can't reach him. He doesn't exactly know where he is. He just knows he's on the sub. Shaw Angel damages Banshee's regulator. Shaw apologizes to Eric for the camp stuff. He says that this was all for Eric. Havoc singes Angel's wings, so she's grounded. Eric gets Shaw to break the room, and Charles is like, oh, it's working. I can hear you now. I can get in there. Because before he couldn't get into the room, let alone touch Shaw, because Shaw's wearing the helmet. The helmet does not look good on Kevin Bacon, but it's not his fault.
Well, not only that, but I think the way that room was constructed in general.
Yeah.
Prevented Charles to actually be able to penetrate anyways.
Yep. So Shaw says he wants to work with Eric, and the world could be ours. Eric takes his helmet, apologizes to Charles, and then Eric argues with Shaw, you know, because Shaw killed his mom.
Well, but it's kind of hard to argue with somebody frozen.
It says agrees. I read it as argues. So Charles freezes Shaw, and Eric actually agrees with Shaw. And this is the problem I have. Essex should have been the villain. I think the Cuban Missile Crisis thing could have been, I think, been done differently. But I think making Eric agree with Shaw was the misstep, because Shaw worked with Nazis and Magneto, no matter how zealous he was, never, ever, 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 ever worked with Nazis. Not with Nathaniel Essex, current continuity bullshit aside, not even the Red Skull. So, no. Making any parallels between Eric and Shaw, who here is a Nazi, no matter how much he says he's not actually a Nazi, is a fucking Nazi. So, no, this is the problem that I have, because they spend so much time establishing that he's the child of survivors and of victims. He is a survivor, and he's a child of the people that perished in the camps. And, you know, the freaking gold bar, the Jewish confiscated gold, right? The gold confiscated by Jews. Oh my God, I'm ranting so hard about this, I can't form coherent sentences. Yes, Eric is a zealot. Yes, Eric has his own version of mutant superiority and what that looks like. It does not come at the cost of nuclear war. So I think they could have done differently and say, like, Eric should have, they could have done so much better with this. I think if this had been Nathaniel Essex, maybe the plan was it should have been something about him trying to start nuclear war so he'd have more mutants to, like, rule over and do experiments on to find the perfect mutant or whatever. That would have been, I think, more interesting. Instead, he's starting nuclear war, so everybody left would become mutants, which is actually not guaranteed. And also no guarantee that he would be in charge of this world. And Eric is like, yep, that sounds like a good idea. So no, that shouldn't have happened. So Shaw still killed his mom. So Eric takes the coin and rams it straight through his head, which should have happened. Like, I feel like this moment would have been a bit more satisfying if they didn't literally 2 seconds beforehand make a parallel about how, make a point that Eric agrees with Shaw. Okay. The coin falls. Stryker advocates the killing/nuking of the mutants on the island. Shocker. Eric presents Shaw's body. Eric feels the guns that are coming, or the rockets that are coming at them. And this is where Fassbender actually loses a bit of his accent, but he recovers pretty well. I think if you don't know it's there, you won't notice it unless you have really good ears. So, Moira tries to get someone to stop it because she's on the island. She tries to, like, reach them over the radio. No one's there. The Soviets and the Americans fire. Eric stops all the rockets, and he turns them around. Charles says that these men aren't innocent. They're just following orders. And this is the other best line in this film. He says, "I've been at mercy of men just following orders. Never again." Also, I have this on my water bottle because that is an epic line. But again, here's the problem. This line is epic. It would have been more epic if you didn't just tie Eric in with a Nazi like Shaw. Like, come on, movie. You were doing so well up until this point. Eric tackles Charles, or Charles tackles Eric. The missiles fall. The kids basically stay out of it.
Well, that's also because Eric told them to stay out of it.
Charles and Eric fire. Moira starts shooting at Eric, but because he knows how to deflect bullets, one bullet actually is redirected and hits Charles in the spine. Eric rushes over. He removes the bullet. No rockets hit the ships. He apologizes to Charles, but tries to kill Moira. Charles blames Eric. I'm like, this is not Eric's fault. I'm sorry, it's not. It's actually the fault of Stryker and those dumbasses who shot rockets at them.
So you want to know something? You want to know about irony?
Sure.
So let's go back to bit when Eric is training with Charles. Eric asks Charles to shoot him point blank.
And Charles says, "I can't shoot my friend."
Yeah. Well, hold on, let me finish. He states he can deflect it. This comes back at the end where Moira shoots at Magneto to stop him from sending the missiles back.
I said that.
And he easily deflects the bullets. One bullet hits Charles to paralyze him. Now, let's go further back. In a scene where Havoc is learning to shoot straight in the bomb shelter, Charles and Hank are standing right to either side of a target mannequin. Charles says with light emphasis, "And try not to hit me. There's a good chap." A little odd, considering Hank is just as likely to get hit, so it should be us. And of course, later in the movie, of course, Charles is hit by the bullet. Standing right next to its intended target of Eric.
And so it's all their fault.
But then, this is like the bonus scene. Before the attack at the CIA base, Havoc beats Darwin at a pinball game. Darwin declares, "Jesus, man, you're killing me." To which then later, Shaw uses the energy absorbed from Havoc's blast to kill Darwin.
Yeah, that's just a little too meta for me. Anyway.
but that was the point, though. Yes. If you actually look at the sequences and other
I'm not arguing with you.
Like, the whole thing were, like, especially with Havoc doing the testing in there, and Charles is like, "Don't hit me."
Yes. So anyway, Charles blames Eric, even though it's really not Eric's fault. Moira should have just, like, not shot at Eric, just saying. And Eric says that they both want the same thing. Charles says no. Eric says that the answer is, like, society. We need to form our own. He says no more hiding. And Charles, like, actually tells Raven to, like, go with him. Like, you're blaming this guy, says that they don't want the same thing, but you also still tell your sister to go with him because she wants to? Best move, Charles.
I think, though, at this point, though,
he
realizes that, you know, he's been kind of, you know, she's been the pet. It's time to let her become herself.
No, don't get me wrong. Yeah. I get all of that. It's just, like, kind of awkward timing.
Yeah, I mean...
So anyway, Azazel, Angel, the Wind Guy all go with Mystique and with Magneto.
The Wind Guy.
I don't remember his name. I'm sorry. I'm sure he has a name. But then Mystique says mutant and proud, and they teleport out. I love how easily Azazel and this Wind Guy just, like, okay, he's in charge now, that's fine, it's no big.
His name is Janos Quested, aka Riptide.
Riptide, they never use his name. So remember the rule, if they do not state the character's name, then it does not matter if the IMDb actually credits him with a name.
Man in black.
So Charles can't feel his legs, he says that. So Charles opens a school, and he says something about going bald.
Well, he makes a joke about not wanting to go bald.
And Moira makes a joke about the X-Men. Moira's memory gets erased after they kiss, and Moira briefs the CIA. Then we see have some misogynistic comments from the CIA men, because she remembers the kiss and nothing else. But there's a crash, and Emma has, and Eric has a, basically, they hear, like, an explosion or something crashing, and we flash to Emma's cell. And Eric shows up, and he's got a fancy new outfit. He's repainted the helmet. And he's like, I believe it's Eric. He goes, he says something like, I prefer Magneto.
And honestly, when he says that, he kind of lets his accent slip on that, too.
I didn't notice it that time, but I'm okay with that. It's
well,
fine.
I watched it this morning. Before I
oh
had to go,
no you're I right he does he does
and it sounds like when like she goes Eric I believe it is and he goes you know I can't do the accent but when he says you know I prefer Magneto
yeah
you right. kind of get that accent a bit there
so
but maybe that was done on purpose to differentiate Eric from Magneto
so you don't know yes I think it was just a slip honestly but
yeah,
anyway
probably. I can dream.
So yeah, I think we've pretty much touched base on pretty much all of the issues I had with this movie. The parallel between Shaw and Eric was unnecessary. But then this also goes back to what I said initially. Shaw was the wrong choice. Don't get me wrong. Kevin Bacon was amazing. But it should have been Essex and it should have been Mr. Sinister.
Kevin Bacon plays good villains.
He does play good villains. I said this in the beginning. And I think you wouldn't have even had to recast. You could have kept Eric. Kevin Bacon, and just had him play Nathaniel Essex instead of, like, Sebastian Shaw.
And another point about Kevin Bacon, he is a huge comic book fan, too.
You said that, yeah. Which
I said that about Matthew Vaughn.
Oh.
Kevin Bacon is also a huge comic book fan because he used the comics to help research to get ready for the role, too.
Which, again, if it had been Nathaniel Essex, would have been so much more interesting.
Do you know what the interesting, though, is? They might have had him read up on Nathaniel Essex, or he might have known of Essex, and he maybe tried to put a bit of that into his character, knowing the fact that they weren't going to use it.
No, not really, no. I mean, like, they sort of hint at it at the very beginning of the film, when he's in, like, Nazi Germany, or, I guess, Nazi-occupied Poland, technically, but... But it doesn't really, it's like, oh, this is just something he did only during World War II and never again. But there's also like kind of this allusion to Shaw as Dr. Mengele based on the laboratory, which again makes me think that they wanted Nathaniel Essex to actually be the villain because he would have been a darker villain. It would have been so much interesting. And it would have actually made some of the things that happen in Days of Future Past make a little bit more sense. But we'll get to that in a couple of weeks. I really like the chemistry between McAvoy and Fassbender. I thought they had a lot of really good chemistry. They played off each other really well.
They've actually done other stuff together. They were in Band of Brothers together. So they've actually had opportunities to work together before.
And it shows. And I think that makes the casting make more sense. I think, like, Fassbender looks the way I would picture a young Magneto to look like. Like, they did a really great job with casting. With exception of Jennifer Lawrence, I think, and Nicholas Holt. I think Nicholas Holt was the wrong actor to pick for this role. He never ends up feeling like Hank McCoy, like Beast. In the same way that Jennifer Lawrence doesn't really feel like Mystique, she just looks like an annoying girl playing Mystique. But Mystique is also completely useless in this movie, except for like one time where she like pretends to be Shaw to save either Havoc or Beast or something when they're fighting with Azazel. Literally twice she's useful in this entire movie. Like, she doesn't even do anything when they're finally on the beach. You could have picked a different character. I don't really have one off the top of my head that they could have gone with. I mean, I guess I know they didn't want to use any of the characters from the previous films, but there were other X-Men they could have gone with that I think would have worked better. Again, I don't have one off the top of my head, but this is where I'm at. Mystique was pointless. And she continues to be pointless and useless throughout this these movies. Also, I find it interesting that Rosamund Pike was apparently considered for Moira and for Emma, and she can't act. Like, I don't know how many movies I've seen with Rosamund Pike. She cannot act. I don't understand how people keep hiring her. So I am glad they went with, what is her name?
January Jones.
For Emma Frost. I really wish we could have seen her in other movies.
Well, interestingly.
The X-Men films, I mean. Because
interestingly, because January Jones is not really known as a great actress. There was talk about the girl that played Emma Frost in Origins Wolverine bringing her back and playing Emma Frost.
But I'm glad they didn't. I think January Jones did a fine job. She had that like classy suaveness that had a lot of sex appeal, which is basically Emma. Emma is just like, they could have made her a little bit bitchier, but she was like a cold, sassy bitch in this, which I really, really liked. So kudos to January Jones, because I think this was the first time I actually saw her in anything. And I really liked her. I liked what she brought to the role. I really like the actor who plays Alex Summers. He is a delight. If you have not seen the new MacGyver, I highly recommend it because he's a treasure.
Lucas Till.
I really like him. He's a good actor. I think this movie, also funny enough, this movie doesn't have a Stan Lee cameo, which I don't care. But it bears noting for other people that care. And I think this movie didn't need the cameo.
It's the second time he didn't do a cameo in X-Men. Mm-hmm. The first time being X2. And honestly, it's one of those where, the filming was too far away from where he was and they couldn't make it work. But at the same time, when you actually look at it at the same time, where could they have made it work?
I mean, in the bar scenes would have been fine, at the CIA building anywhere. But like, again, nobody misses him, so it doesn't matter. In this movie, like there's like nobody here looking for a Stanley cameo because there's so much going on.
Yeah, and well, that kind of comes back to my point of it wouldn't fit, so it's okay not to have it.
Yeah. So my final thoughts is that this movie does a great job of setting a really good standalone story that could have led to some really good sequels to really make it a solid interwoven trilogy. But because somebody has a hard-on for Wolverine, I'm not allowed to be happy. So as we get
Are you talking about Bryan Singer?
Yeah, always. Okay. I'm not even I don't know if he directed the Wolverine. I don't care.
Bryan Singer had nothing to do with the Wolverine movies.
Still don't care. But anyway, as we get from 2 weeks from now, so keep this in mind, when we get to Days of Future Past, we actually see that Bryan Singer almost really rudely tosses out a lot of the characters that Matthew Vaughn introduced in this movie for no reason other than he didn't want to use them. And I think it's kind of it's almost like he was bitter because Vaughn got to direct X-Men First Class and they brought him, and then Fox brought him in for Days of Future Past, which I will have so many rants about Days of Future Past when we get there, but that is something to keep in mind and something to look forward to. But apparently next week, as I found out at the beginning of this podcast, we're not going to the 70s. We're actually going to Japan.
Yes. So real quick, while we were recording this episode, I was also updating the episode listing for us because I had to change a couple things. So the order now moving forward is going to be The Wolverine, Days of Future Past, Deadpool, Apocalypse, Logan, Deadpool 2, Dark Phoenix, and then The New Mutants, which we both need to see that. So
Did you say Deadpool 2?
Yes. Deadpool 2 is after Logan.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so I inserted Deadpool because, you know, as we'll talk about when we get the Days of Future Past, it actually resets the timeline, which undoes a lot of stuff, which then opens the door for
Deadpool. We'll get there.
Technicalities.
Mike, how did this movie do on IMDb compared to the previous compared to the last shit show?
Man, I gotta put an NSFW next to this thing now.
Yeah, sorry. I had a lot of feelings. Wait until we get to Days of Future Past. There will be significantly more.
All right, so I'm gonna throw this out there real quick. I'm gonna do budgets since we did that last time too. Budget was $160 million estimated to make the film. Opening weekend in the United States was $55 million. Gross in the U.S. was $146 million. And cumulative world gross was over $352 million. So obviously it made money. I kind of put that out there because this is also around the time when Captain America came out. So... or one of the Captain Americas came out.
The first one. That was the first Avenger.
Yeah, so I'm putting that out there for a reason. So it actually did hold its own pretty well with Captain America out. This film clocked in at 2 hours and 11 minutes and did a 7.7 out of 10.
That's not bad.
I want to throw this out there real quick. There was actually another superhero movie that he actually got to do before X-Men First Class, that he got to direct. And it was actually a direct result of him not being able to do Last Stand.
Which is? Was it Kick-Ass?
Yep. He did Kick-Ass, which is also...
I was not a fan of that movie, but I
like the first one. I'm not big on the second one.
I don't think I ever saw the second one, but, like, I just never quite jived with the style of the gritty and the dark and the... It's not my thing, but anyway.
Well, see, that was also a darker graphic novel compared to
Kingsman. I know, but that doesn't mean I like, not, you know.
But also, it should be noted that he also directed Layer Cake, which is a very acclaimed cult film.
I also don't do cult films, but good for him, good for him. Like I said, I appreciated his direction with this film. I appreciate that it was a very solid, very tight story. I don't think there's any like real plot holes in it. Killing Darwin was a mistake. Like, if you didn't know what to do with him, don't introduce him. Again, there's like a plethora of like I'm looking at my Marvel poster right now. I'm looking at my X-Men comics. Like, there's so many characters you could do so much with, but you chose like... If you're like, this is my problem with some of the Fox films, is like they introduce characters that have a lot of potential, but then don't do jack shit with them, or they just don't name them. But then you have to go to the credits and find out which character it was supposed to be, and then I get angry because it's a waste of a character. Like when we get to Old Man Wolverine, they have Richter allegedly. Like, I'm calling bullshit on that. That is not Richter. You just threw that in there for points with the nerds who know these characters, and you wasted them. All right, so with that, Michael, where can the people find you on the social medias?
I can't believe I got to put an NSFW on this episode now. This is not awesome media, damn it.
But, it is now.
You can find me on the Twitters at @TheLindenbaum75, Facebook at facebook.com/X75Productions, on Twitch, where I stream Sundays, Mondays, Tuesdays, and Thursdays from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. Eastern time. Yes, this is actually a set schedule now. It's awesome. I know, it's so special. At twitch.tv/TheMichaelX75. Feel free to subscribe. You can do bits, all that cool stuff. I have funny commands that you can do as well. And of course, you can go to the website at txhdhockey.com, and for the show specifically, /nerdy-notions.
And for me, of course, as one of you has already found this podcast through me and sent me lovely messages, who is one of my favorite people to hear from on Tumblr. She knows who she is. You can find me at geekall101.tumblr.com, Geeky Captain on Instagram, Geeky Kaplan on Twitter. I tweet now. It's kind of scary, but I'm on Twitter. And of course, you can see my comic book reviews on geekycaptainwrites.wordpress.com. I just reviewed the first 2 issues of Champions, which is doing their Outlawed storyline and is written by Eve Allie Ewing, and it is phenomenal. Go check it out. Thank you so much for listening, and please tune in next time as we head over to Japan, and I have to deal with my least favorite X-Men character in The Wolverine.